9. By the time Sisu approached Lothian, Thorby had a battle station worthy of a man. His first assignment had been to assist in the central dressing station, an unnecessary job, but his background in mathematics got him promoted. He had been attending the ship's school. Baslam had given him a broad education, but this fact did not stand out to his instructors, since most of what they regarded as necessary, the Finnish language as they spoke it, the history of the people and of Sisu, trading customs, business practices, and export and import laws of many planets, hydroponics and ship's economy, ship safety and damage control, were subjects that Baslam had not even touched. He had emphasized languages, science, mathematics, galactography, and history. The new subjects Thorby gobbled with the speed possible only to one Renshod by Baslam's strenuous methods. The traders needed applied mathematics, bookkeeping and accounting, astrogation, nucleonics for a hydrogen fusion-powered end ship. Thorby splashed through the first. The second was hardly more difficult. But as for the third, the ship's schoolmaster was astounded that this ex-fracky had already studied multidimensional geometries. So he reported to the captain that they had a mathematical genius aboard. This was not true, but it got Thorby reassigned to the starboard fire control computer. The greatest hazard to trading ships is in the first and last legs of each jump, when a ship is below speed of light. It is theoretically possible to detect and intercept a ship going many times speed of light, when it is irrational to the fourth-dimensional space of the senses. In practice, it is about as easy as hitting a particular raindrop with a bow and arrow during a storm at midnight. But it is feasible to hunt down a ship moving below speed of light if the attacker is fast and the victim is a big, lumbering freighter. The Sisu had acceleration of 100 standard gravities and used it all to cut down the hazard time. But a ship which speeds up by a kilometer per second each second will take 3.5 standard days to reach speed of light. Half a week is a long, nervous time to wait. Doubling acceleration would have cut danger time by half and made the Sisu as agile as a raider, but it would have meant a hydrogen fission chamber 8 times as big, with parallel increase in radiation shielding, auxiliary equipment, and paramagnetic capsule to contain the hydrogen reaction. The added mass would eliminate cargo capacity. Traders are working people. Even if there were no parasites preying on them, they could not afford to burn their profits in the inexorable workings of an exponential law of multidimensional physics. So the Sisu had the best legs she could afford, but not long enough to outrun a ship unburdened by cargo. Nor could Sisu maneuver easily. She had to go precisely in the right direction when she entered the trackless night of end space, else when she came out she would be too far from market. Such a mistake could turn the ledger from black to red. Still more hampering, her skipper had to be prepared to cut power entirely, or risk having his in-ship artificial gravity field destroyed, and thereby make strawberry jam of the family, as soft bodies were suddenly exposed to 100 gravities. This is why a captain gets stomach ulcers. It isn't dickering for cargoes, figuring discounts and commissions, and trying to guess what goods will show the best return. It's not long jumps through the black. That is when he can relax and dandle babies. It is starting and ending a jump that kills him off. The long, aching hours when he may have to make a split-second decision involving the lives or freedom of his family. If raiders wished to destroy merchant ships, Sisu and her sisters would not stand a chance. But the raider wants loot and slaves. It gains him nothing simply to blast a ship. Merchantmen are limited by no qualms, and attacking ship's destruction is the ideal outcome. Atomic target seekers are dreadfully expensive, and using them up is rough on profit and loss. But there is no holding back if the computer says the target can be reached, whereas a raider will use destruction weapons only to save himself. His tactic is to blind the traitor, burn out her instruments so that he can get close enough to paralyze everyone aboard, or, failing that, kill without destroying ship and cargo. The traitor runs if she can, fights if she must. But when she fights to kill. Whenever Sisu was below speed of light, she listened with artificial senses to every disturbance in multispace. The whisper of end-space communication, or the white roar of a ship boosting at many gravities. Data poured into the ship's astrogational analog of space, and the questions were, where is this other ship? What is its course, speed, acceleration? Can it catch us before we reach end space? If the answers were threatening, digested data channeled into port and starboard fire control computers, and Sisu braced herself to fight. Ordnance men armed A-bomb target seekers caressed their sleek sides and muttered charms. The chief engineer unlocked the suicide switch, which could let the power plant become a hydrogen bomb of monstrous size, and prayed that, in final extremity, he would have the courage to deliver his people into the shelter of death. The captain sounded the clangor calling the ship from watch and watch to general quarters. Cooks switched off fires. Auxiliary engineers closed down air circulation. Farmers said goodbye to their green-growing things and hurried to fighting stations. Mothers with babies mustered, then strapped down and held those babies tightly. Then the waiting started. But not for Thorby, not for those assigned to fire control computers, sweating into their straps. For the next minutes or hours, the life of Sisu is in their hands. The fire control computer machines, chewing with millisecond meditation data from the analog, decide whether or not torpedoes can reach target, then offer four answers. Ballistic possible or impossible for projected condition. Yes or no for condition changed by one ship, or the other, or both, through cutting power. These answers automatic circuits could handle alone, but machines do not think. Half of each computer is designed to allow the operator to ask what the situation might be in the far future of 5 minutes or so from now, if variables change, and whether the target might be reached under such changes. Any variable can be shaded by human judgment. An intuitive projection by a human operator can save his ship or lose it. A paralysis beam travels at speed of light. Torpedoes never have time to get up to more than a few hundred kilometers per second. Yet it is possible for Raider to come within beaming range, have his pencil of paralyzing radiation on its way, and the traitor to launch a target seeker before the beam strikes, and still be saved when the outlaw flames into atomic mist a little later. But if the operator is too eager by a few seconds, or overly cautious by the same, he can lose his ship. Too eager, the missile will fail to reach target. Too cautious, it will never be launched. Seasoned oldsters are not good at these jobs. The perfect fire controlman is an adolescent, or young man or woman, fast in thought and action, confident, with intuitive grasp of mathematical relations beyond rote and rule, and not afraid of death he cannot yet imagine. The traders must be always alert for such youngsters. Thorby seemed to have the feel for mathematics. He might have the other talents for a job, something like chess, played under terrific pressure, and a fast game of spatball. His mentor was Jerry Kingsolver, his nephew and roommate. Jerry was junior in family rank, but appeared to be older. He called Thorby Uncle outside the computer room. On the job, Thorby called him Starboard Senior Fire Controlman, and added Sir. During long weeks of the dive through dark toward Lozian, Jerry drilled Thorby. Thorby was supposed to be training for hydroponics, and Jerry was the supercargo's senior clerk, but the ship had plenty of farmers, and the supercargo's office was never very busy in space. Captain Krause had directed Jerry to keep Thorby hard at it in the computer room. Since the ship remained at battle stations for half a week while boosting to speed of light, each fighting station had two persons assigned watch and watch. Jerry's junior controlman was his younger sister, Maida. The computer had twin consoles, either of which could command by means of a selector switch. At general quarters, they sat side by side, with Jerry controlling and Maida ready to take over. After a stiff course in what the machine could do, Jerry put Thorby at one console, Maida at the other, and fed them problems from the ship's control room. each console recorded. It was possible to see what decisions each operator had made and how these compared with those made in battle, for the data were from records, real or threatened battles in the past. Shortly, Thorby became extremely irked. Maida was enormously better at it than he was. So he tried harder and got worse. While he sweated, trying to outguess a slave raider which had once been on Sisu's screens, he was painfully aware of a slender, dark, rather pretty girl beside him, her swift fingers making tiny adjustments among keys and knobs, changing a bias or modifying a vector, herself relaxed and unhurried. It was humiliating afterwards to find that his pace-sitter had saved the ship while he had failed. Worse still, he was aware of her as a girl and did not know it. All he knew was that she made him uneasy. After one run, Jerry called from ship's control, "End of drill, stand by." He appeared shortly and examined their tapes, reading marks on sensitized paper as another might read print. He pursed his lips over Thorby's record. "Trainee, you fired 3 times, and not a one of your beasts got within 50,000 kilometers of the enemy. We don't mind expense, it's merely grandmother's blood. But the object is to blast him, not scare him into a fit. You have to wait until you can hit." "I did my best." "Not good enough. Let's see yours, sis." The nickname irritated Thorby still more. Brother and sister were fond of each other and did not bother with titles, so Thorby had tried using their names and had been snubbed. He was trainee. They were senior controlman and junior controlman. There was nothing he could do. At drill, he was junior. For a week, Thorby addressed Jerry as foster ortho-nephew outside of drills, and Jerry had carefully addressed him by family title. Then Thorby decided it was silly and went back to calling him Jerry. But Jerry continued to call him trainee during drill, and so did Maida. Jerry looked over his sister's record and nodded. "Very nice, sis. You're within a second of post-analyzed optimum, and 3 seconds better than the shot that got the so-and-so. I have to admit, that's sweet shooting, because the real run is my own." "That raider off Ingstall, remember?"
"I certainly do."
She glanced at Thorby. Thorby felt disgusted. "It's not fair." He started hauling at safety belt buckles. Jerry looked surprised. "What, trainee?"
"I said it's not fair. You send down a problem, I tackle it cold, and get bawled out because I'm not perfect. But all she had to do is to fiddle with controls to get an answer she already knows, to make me look cheap."
Maida was looking stricken. Thorby headed for the door.
"I never asked for this. I'm going to the captain and ask for another job."
"Trainee?" Thorby stopped. Jerry went on quietly. "Sit down. When I'm through, you can see the captain, if you think it's advisable." Thorby sat down. "I've 2 things to say," Jerry continued, coldly. "First," he turned to his sister, "Junior Controlman, did you know what problem this was when you were tracking?"
"No, Senior Controlman."
"Have you worked it before?"
"I don't think so."
"How was it you remembered it?"
"What? Why, you said it was the raider off Ingstall. I'll never forget because of the dinner afterwards. You sat with great-grandma, with the chief officer."
Jerry turned to Thorby. "You see, she tracked it cold as I had to when it happened, and she did even better than I did. I'm proud to have her as my junior tracker. For your information, Mr. Stupid Junior Trainee, this engagement took place before the junior controlman became a trainee. She hasn't even run it in practice. She's just better at it than you are."
"All right," Thorby said, sullenly. "I'll probably never be any good. I said I wanted to quit."
"I'm talking. Nobody asks for this job. It's a headache. Nobody quits it, either. After a while, the job quits him. When post-analysis shows that he is losing his touch. Maybe I'm beginning to, but I promise you this. You'll either learn, or I will go to the captain and tell him you don't measure up. In the meantime, if I have any lip out of you, I'll haul you up before the chief officer." He snapped. "Extra drill run. Battle stations. Cast loose your equipment." He left the room. Moments later, his voice reached them. "Bogey, starboard computer room, report."
The call to dinner sounded. Maida said gravely,
Starboard tracker manned, data showing starting run. Her fingers started caressing keys. Thorby bent over his own controls. He wasn't hungry anyhow. For days, Thorby spoke with Jerry only formally. He saw Maida at drill or across the lounge at meals. He treated her with cold correctness and tried to do as well as she did. He could have seen her at other times. Young people associated freely in public places. She was taboo to him, both as his niece and because they were of the same moiety. But that was no bar to social relations.
Jerry he could not avoid. They ate at the same table, slept in the same room. But Thorby could, and did, throw up a barrier of formality. No one said anything. These things happen. Even Fritz pretended not to notice. But one afternoon, Thorby dropped into the lounge to see a story film with a Sarganese background. Thorby sat through it to pick it to pieces, but when it was over he could not avoid noticing Maida because she walked over, stood in front of him, addressed him humbly as her uncle, and asked if he would care for a game of spat ball before supper. He was about to refuse when he noticed her face. She was watching him with tragic eagerness. So he answered, "Why, thanks, Maida. Work up an appetite." She broke into smiles.
"Good. I've got Ilsa holding a table. Let's."
Thorby beat her 3 games and tied 1, a remarkable score since she was female champion and was allowed only 1-point handicap when playing the male champion. But he did not think about it. He was enjoying himself. His performance picked up, partly through the grimness with which he worked, partly because he did have feeling for complex geometry, and partly because the beggar's boy had had his brain sharpened by an ancient discipline. Jerry never again compared aloud the performances of Maida and Thorby and gave only brief comments on Thorby's results. "Better," or "coming along," and eventually, "you're getting there." Thorby's morale soared. He loosened up and spent more time socially, playing spat ball with Maida rather frequently. Toward the end of Journey Through Darkness, they finished the last drill one morning, and Jerry called out, "Stand easy, I'll be a few minutes." Thorby relaxed from pleasant strain, but after a moment he fidgeted. He had a hunch that he had been in tune with his instruments. "Junior Controlman, do you suppose he would mind if I looked at my tape?"
"I don't think so," Maida answered. "I'll take it out. Then it's my responsibility."
"I don't want to get you in trouble."
"You won't,"
Maida answered, serenely. She reached back of Thorby's console, pulled out the strip record, blew on it to keep it from curling, and examined it. Then she pulled her own strip, compared the two. She looked at him gravely.
"That's a very good run, Thorby."
It was the first time she had ever spoken his name, but Thorby hardly noticed.
"Really? You mean it?"
"It's a very good run, Thorby.
We both got hits, but yours is optimum, between possible and critical limit, whereas mine is too eager. See?"
Thorby could read strips only haltingly, but he was happy to take her word for it. Jerry came in, took both strips, looked at Thorby's, then looked more closely. "I dug up the post-analysis before I came down," he said.
"Yes, sir,"
Thorby said eagerly. "I'll check it after chow, but it looks as if your mistakes had canceled out." Maida said,
"Why, Bud, that's a perfect run, and you know it."
"Suppose it is," Jerry grinned. "You wouldn't want our star pupil to get a swelled head, would you?"
"Pooh."
"Right back at you, small and ugly sister. Let's go to chow." They went through a narrow passage into trunk corridor of second deck, where they walked abreast. Thorby gave a deep sigh.
"Trouble?"
his nephew asked.
Not a bit."
Thorby put an arm around each of them. "Jerry, you and Maida are going to make a marksman out of me yet." It was the first time Thorby had addressed his teacher by name since the day he had received the scorching. But Jerry accepted his uncle's overture without stiffness.
"Don't get your hopes up, bunkmate, but I think we've got it licked," he added. "I see Great Aunt Tora is giving us her famous cold eye. If anybody wants my opinion, I think Sis can walk unassisted. I'm sure Great Aunt thinks so."
"Pooh to her, too," Maida said, briskly. "Thorby just made a perfect run." Sisu came out of darkness, dropping below speed of light. Lozian's sun blazed less than 50 billion kilometers away. In a few days, they would reach their next market. The ship went to watch and watch battle stations. Maida took her watch alone. Jerry required the trainee to stand watches with him. The first watch was always free from strain. Even if a raider had accurate information via N-space communicator of Sisu's time of departure and destination, it was impossible in a jump of many light years to predict the exact time and place where she would poke her nose out into rational space. Jerry settled in his chair some minutes after Thorby had strapped down with that age-old tense feeling that this time it was not practice. Jerry grinned at him. "Relax. If you get your bloodstream loaded, your back'll ache, and you'll never last." Thorby grinned feebly. "A try." "That's better. We're going to play a game." Jerry pulled a box-like contrivance out of a pocket, snapped it open.
"What is that?"
"A killjoy. It fits here." Jerry slipped it over the switch that determined which console was in command.
"Can you see the switch?"
No. "Hand the man the prize." Jerry fiddled with the switch behind the screen. "Which of us is in control in case we have to launch a bomb now?"
"Well, how can I tell?"
"Take that off, Jerry. It makes me nervous."
"That's the game. Maybe I'm controlling, and you're just going through motions. Maybe you are the man at the trigger, and I'm asleep in my chair."
"Every so often I'll fiddle with the switch, but you won't know how I've left it. So when a flap comes, and one will, I feel it in my bones, you can't assume that good old Jerry, the man with the micrometer fingers, has the situation under control. You might have to save the firm. You." Thorby had a queasy vision of waiting men and bombs in the missile room below, waiting for him to solve precisely an impossible problem of life and death, of warped space and shifting vectors and complex geometry.
"Huh, you're kidding," he said feebly. "You wouldn't leave me in control. Why, the captain would skin you alive."
That's where you're wrong. There always comes a day when a trainee makes his first real run. After that, he's a controlman, or an angel. But we don't let you worry at the time. Oh, no, we just keep you worried all the time. Now, here's the game. Anytime I say now, you guess who has control. You guess right, I owe you one dessert. You guess wrong, you owe me one. Now, Thorby thought quickly. I guess I've got it.
Wrong, Jerry lifted the killjoy.
You owe me one dessert, and it's berry tart tonight. My mouth is watering. But faster. You're supposed to make quick decisions. Now. You've still got it.
So I have. Even.
Now. You.
Nope. See?
And I eat your tart.
Huh.
I ought to quit while I'm ahead. Love that juice. Now. When Maida relieved them, Jerry owned Thorby's desserts for the next 4 days.
We start again with that score, Jerry said, except that I'm going to collect that berry tart. But I forgot to tell you the big prize.
Which is?
Comes a real thing? We bet 3 desserts. After it's over, you guess, and we settle. Always bet more on real ones.
Maida sniffed. But are you trying to make him nervous?
Are you nervous, Thorby?
Nope.
Quit fretting, sis. Got it firmly in your grubby little hands?
I relieve you, sir.
Come on, Thorby, let's eat.
Berry tarts. Ah.
3 days later, the score stood even, but only because Thorby had missed most of his desserts. Sisu was enormously slowed, almost to planetary speeds, and Lozian's sun loomed large on the screens. Thorby decided, with mildest regret, that his ability to fight would not be tested this jump. Then, the general alarm made him rear up against safety belts. Jerry had been talking. His head jerked around. He looked at displays, and his hands moved to his controls.
"Get on it!" he yelped. "This one's real!"
Thorby snapped out of shock and bent over his board. The analog globe was pouring data to them. The ballistic situation had built up. Good heavens, it was close, and matching in fast. How had anything moved in so close without being detected? Then he quit thinking and started investigating answers. No, not yet. Before long, though, could the bandit turn a little at that boost and reduce his approach? Try a projection at an assumed 6 gravities of turning. Would a missile reach him? Would it still reach him if he did not? He hardly felt Maida's gentle touch on his shoulder, but he heard Jerry snap, "Stay out, sis! We're on it! We're on it!" A light blinked on Thorby's board. The squawk horn sounded,
"Friendly craft! Friendly craft! Losian Planetary Patrol identified! Return to watch and watch!"
Thorby took a deep breath, felt a great load lift.
"Continue your run!" screamed Jerry.
"Huh?
Finish your run! That's no Losian craft, that's a raider! Losians can't maneuver that way! You've got it, boy, you've got it! Nail him!"
Thorby heard Maida's frightened gasp, but he was again at his problem. Change anything? Could he reach him? Could he still reach him in the cone of possible maneuver? Now! He armed his board and let the computer give the order on projection. He heard Jerry's voice faintly. Jerry seemed to be talking very slowly.
"Missile away. I think you got him. But you were eager. Get off another one before their beam hits us."
Automatically, Thorby complied. Time was too short to try another solution. He ordered the machine to send another missile according to projection. He then saw by his board that the target was no longer under power and decided with a curiously empty feeling that his first missile had destroyed it.
"That's all," Jerry announced. "Now."
What? "Who had it? You or me? 3 desserts.
"I had it," Thorby said with certainty.
In another level, he decided that he would never really be a traitor. To Jerry, that target had been just Fracky, or 3 desserts.
"Wrong. That puts me 3 up.
I turned coward and kept control myself. Of course, the bombs were disarmed and the launchers locked as soon as the captain gave the word, but I didn't have the nerve to risk an accident with a friendly ship."
"Friendly ship?"
"Of course. But for you, Assistant Junior Controlman, it was your first real one, as I intended." Thorby's head floated. Maida said,
"But you're mean to Collect. You cheated."
"Sure I cheated. But he's a blooded controlman now, just the same. And I'm going to Collect, just the very same. Ice cream tonight.